You're listening to Architecture Masters.
I was one of only, it's four brothers, basically, and I was the only one who went to university, primarily because I got a grant. So actually, initially, I wanted to be a writer or a journalist. So I kind of studied literature. I used to read a lot. You know, I did a degree in English, in literature, but I was always, you know, I was always good at drawing as well. As I draw a lot of stuff, comics and stuff like that, and sketching, but particularly buildings. So I think it was only a matter of time before I actually realised I didn't really want to be a journalist, I wanted to be an architect. And actually, that was enough to get into architecture school.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
Hello, my name's Frank Anatole. I'm Principal Architect at Network Rail.
For this episode of Architecture Masters, we're joined by Frank Anatole, Principal Architect at Network Rail. Network Rail oversees a vast network of built environment infrastructure across the UK, including over 2,500 stations, 30,000 bridges and tunnels, as well as countless maintenance depots, signal boxes, and other infrastructure buildings that all too often go unseen. Frank and his team don't generally design new projects themselves. Much of that is done by external architecture practices. But rather, they oversee the process of setting design standards, policy, and long-term planning, as well as the process of assuring that external designs are fit for purpose. But both Frank and his colleague Anthony Dewar, Network Rail's professional head of buildings and architecture, have focused on improving the organisation's design ambition, including through ambitious new design guidance. All forms of design have long played a role in the evolution of British Railways. The still iconic double arrow logo, originally of British Rail, is still one of the country's most recognised logos. And an exhibition at the Design Museum in London currently celebrates the graphic design legacy of Margaret Calvert's work on the railways. Frank started his career working at Hampshire County Council Architects before spending a formative period working in Paris on a number of French station designs. Back in the UK, he worked for a number of practices, including a decade at Marks Barfield, where he worked on the designs for the London Eye and the I360 in Brighton. I joined Frank down the line from his home in Kent, where I started by asking about how he was settling in to working from home.
Yeah, I mean, I work increasingly from home. I did work from home anyway, to a certain extent, because just the nature of my work. I spend about 2 days in the office, really.
And the office is where?
The office officially is Milton Keynes. I live in London, but it's Milton Keynes. And, you know, I go up to Milton Keynes twice a week. And that gave me the rest of the week really to do what I like doing, which is going around seeing sites and stations. And, you know, I can work at home developing policy and standards and stuff like that. It's something that happens in the background. And, you know, COVID hasn't really affected that, really, because it's not like I have to go out daily to a site and then take precautions. I can be quite selective about, you know, which sites I go to, and if the risk level is high as it is at the moment, I can choose not to go. Yeah. So COVID hasn't really affected it.
You've kind of touched upon it a little bit there, this idea about, I guess, the kind of number of different roles that architects can have in different jobs. You know, you've obviously trained as an architect, but you're not designing buildings day to day as your principal amount of work. Talk to us maybe a little bit about what Principal Architect at Network Rail, you've obviously had other jobs which have been perhaps more engaged in the day-to-day design detail, but you're working with external architects on a lot of projects when it gets to the... Just talk us through a little bit about the work.
Okay, so I suppose what you... I've kind of morphed into a... Not morphed, but I kind of matured, probably matured into the role of an assurance architect. Obviously, you know, the older you get, the more experience you have. And I'd like to think, you know, I've been working in transport now for over 25 years, and I have a technical knowledge, which is very valuable. And I like to think it, you know, enables me to spot bad design and to assure the design is good. So, you know, and I've done design. I've got nothing to prove in terms of, you know, am I a good designer? I think I am. Because I've been very lucky to be involved in some really great projects and I've contributed to those, so I know I can do it. But, you know, the assurance part really interests me because, especially working for an organization like Network Rail, I think who don't really have a huge or a great track record of champion design. I think it's happened in bursts, you know, fits and bursts, really. Mm. There was a sort of burst, you know, post-war, just after the Festival of Britain. And then in the mid-60s, it's part of a branding exercise. And then you could say immediately sort of before privatization in the 80s, there was a short burst when they brought in Jane Priestman as a sort of design champion. But then it's kind of, you know, it's been uneven. One of the things that really prompted me to join Network Rail was this kind of new... Well, first of all, publishing design principles. When I was interviewed by Anthony Dewar, he said, look, we've got these new design principles that we're working on. I thought that was really interesting because I don't think Network Rail have ever, or British Rail have ever, sort of published design principles as a policy, principles of good design. And I thought that's pretty radical. That really convinced me that Network Rail were positive about design. And I think it reflects a little bit of a, you know, you can see some winds of change there, you know, the CEO, Chief Exec Andrew Haynes, and Peter Hendy, both, I think, come from sort of, well, more design so Peter Hendy, but design backgrounds, And that's very, very evident. It's very supportive. Mm. It's a motivating force for me, really. And the fact that it's aligned with the public sector, and I've always been, you know, heart on heart, I've always been a public sector sort of architect. I've always sort of felt that I had sort of a social purpose. That was quite exciting.
You mentioned there the role of an assurance architect. Oh. Just for people who aren't familiar, just what is an assurance architect and what's that role?
An assurance architect really is someone who you're often called to accept design for on behalf of an organization. So quite bluntly, what I will do is assess whether, you know, the design works from an accessibility point of view, whether it vision and the visual impact, you know, that's been looked at, whether there's an access and maintenance strategy, whether there's, you know, from a fire point of view, there's a fire strategy.
It's similar then to the kind of design review in a sense. Is Okay.
We are sort of, I suppose, you know, one man caves, you know, we're sort of running around the organization saying, oh, does that work? Have you looked at the visual impact? We're helped by kind of assurance process and standards that Network Rail have in place, but you need champions to enforce them sometimes. Some of them are guidelines, some of them are standards. Standards you can kind of, are mandatory, and you can apply those. Guidelines are a little bit more difficult, they're advisory, and projects sometimes for various reasons, program or cost, they'll choose, you know, to try to avoid, you know, doing this.
And how, I mean, I've heard other architects talk about their work on design review panels and things. Is there a temptation ever to sort of, and what stops you really pulling out a red pen and thinking, how about we change this? How about we change that? You know, to sort of redesign or to change, you know, is it kind of almost an editing role, and how does that?
We have to be careful because, you know, if you think about projects are almost like Well, first of all, Network Rail is kind of organised on a regional basis. It's not, you know, and all the regions almost operate like separate companies. So when they commission a designer, they effectively are running that project. So they don't look very kindly on the central technical project coming in and sort of applying a red pen over it and saying, this doesn't work, you know. They expect a certain amount of autonomy. And but what we do is we are responsible for setting a national, you know, standard or a national set of guidelines, and we will enforce. We can enforce those if there's a sort of legal, you know, compulsion.
So your interventions then are not on the basis of I don't like this. They're on the basis of this doesn't fit the standards that we've set.
Yes, we can't really, you know, say, well, actually, I don't really like sort of postmodern. I'm being, you know, in sort of something else. You can't, you know, because that's okay. They won't accept that. So you will have to. There has to be a quite pragmatic reason for saying, well, no, that's not acceptable. It breaks, for example, you know, it's contrary to BS 8300 or, you know, some British standard or code of practice or whatever. But you can talk about how design can affect, you know, a project, and the lack of it can result in non-compliances. Mm. And, you know, when you can make that link, it makes your job easier, and, you know, you end up with better design. The other thing I actually should point out, that the other major kind of watershed moment, I think, that I saw when I joined Network Rail was we established a design panel specifically run by the Design Council.
Right. Okay.
So it's kind of CABE, and that's and the importance was it was an independent design panel, because that's the nature of design panels. Mm. They should be independent. And so we've set up a agreement with the Design Council, and a certain number of projects which trigger a threshold will fall into, you know, what we call the Design Advice Panel. They go up before this panel, and they're reviewed by a number of environment experts. And that's gaining traction at the moment.
And those people are selected through CABE, are they?
Yes. So they have a pool.
So there's a real independence there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they represent all sort of sectors of the built environment. So there'll be accessibility experts, structural engineers, town planners, you know. Mm-hmm. So they can kind of review any, at any stage development, so early stage, sketch scheme, detailed design.
So we'll come on to some of the buildings that obviously Network Rail, you know, when people think about the railways, obviously engineering's a big thing that comes up, but a lot of buildings, St Pancras, you know, I guess our kind of London audience thinking about some of the real changes to stations in London, you know, from dank, horrible places people didn't want to spend any time to, you know, Stirling Prize winning buildings. We'll come on to that in a minute. And I guess some of the other buildings, kind of some of the buildings that are less visible. But I just wanted to sort of jump right back and think about your route into architecture. Am I right that you started as an English literature graduate? Is that right?
Yes, I did. It's funny because I grew up in North East London, Stoke Newton. That's what it wasn't so far. It was quite a... humble background, but
pre-gentrification.
It was definitely. And I was one of only. I mean, it's four brothers basically, and I was the only one who went to university. Primarily because I got a grant from the ILEA that was around at that time. So actually, initially, I wanted to be a writer or a journalist. So I kind of studied literature. I used to read a lot, but I was always, you know, I was always good at drawing as well. I draw a lot of stuff, comics and stuff like that, and sketching, but particularly buildings. So I think it was only a matter of time before I actually realised I didn't really want to be a journalist. I wanted to be an architect because I was drawing buildings so much, and actually that was enough to get into architecture school, but. Effectively, I did a degree in English, in literature, which I completed.
European and English literature. I mean, we'll come on to the European angle in a minute. I mean, there's another line there. But so, and it was at university, was it, that realization?
It was in my second year, because I was the literature section's on the top floor of the library. The architecture section was on the top floor of the library, which was where I studied. Yeah. So I found myself looking more and more at architecture books and thinking, oh, this is kind of tasty. I kind of
it was a gradual, evolution was it then in terms of seeing the books and see, rather than a person or a key moment?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I was kind of, you know, I was struck by a particular architect. I'd always liked Frank Lloyd Wright. I was very keen on that sort of, and you know, it was later on I was to realise it kind of formed like a sort of a modern movement, and I kind of realised that it was very similar to Alvar Aalto, yeah. You know, caring architecture, but was really influencing me. And my first architecture job, actually, it was at Hampshire County Council.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I went there because I was fascinated by social architecture. I think that's where the sort of love of transport came from. Yeah. And so I was doing, you know, I was really interested in school buildings and the sort of caring tradition of Alvar Aalto. I loved what they were doing at Hampshire, and with sort of big roofs, school buildings, and no suspended ceiling.
It's a subject close to my heart. I grew up in Hampshire,
really? Okay.
One of my my second infant school was Hopkins and Partners. In Fleet in Hampshire. So it's an early influence on me too.
Oh, brilliant! That's good to know. Well, I had a really scary interview, probably the scariest interview I'd ever had, with Colin Stanfield Smith.
You know, oh wow! Okay. Time. Yeah.
And he basically put me under the wing of Kate McIntosh to see if she was at Hampshire at that time. So she had me detail. First building I did was a daycare centre. Yeah. It absolutely made me because it was simple enough that I could get my head around all the details, but it was a wonderful building to design, you know. And I went there and met all the residents. I was talking to them about, you know, what they wanted. It was brilliant, absolutely great. So
you can understand that early kind of engagement in social architecture then, and you've talked about public sector work. And
absolutely.
But you did, I mean, what's interesting, you speak to a number of people who perhaps have they've gone off to university in one direction and changed. You did see the English and the degree through.
Yes.
You know, a number of people kind of have this realization in the first year, God, this is not for me, and they go off. But you did. And is that, I'm kind of interested in, we talk a lot about writing, and you know, we see a lot in the festival that often there's the architects often aren't known for their writing. Certainly the stuff that we see is very highbrow and not publicly focused kind of text that people. So I'm just kind of interested really in how that kind of background in literature and language maybe has affected your work.
I've always been interested in literature because of obviously the storytelling, but it's just a way of communication in the same way that kind of you know, sketching, drawing is a form of communication. It's just a slightly different form, I just love reading. My mother loved reading, had loads of books. They actually, one birthday actually got me, you know, the sort of Encyclopedia Britannica set. You know, was this for something else? Or you just
this will keep him busy.
Had you meant to give this to someone else? But no. You know, they, so I was really kind of into that. And the reason I persevered, I mean, I was in my second year, so I felt it would have been just a waste of money, public money, if I didn't complete this. So I felt like I had to. And also, I wasn't sure whether I'd get into architecture school, basically. I sent them a portfolio, I didn't hear anything. And then I wasn't sure I'd get the funding either, because it's a long course. It all worked out. I got accepted.
Brighton.
Brighton.
Moved to Brighton, and you did an undergraduate degree, part one, part two.
Yeah.
At Brighton. All the way to part three. Yeah.
Yeah. Then went off to Hampshire, which I absolutely loved. I actually loved it so much. I stayed there for 2 years, and then came back to Brighton, and then finished my diploma.
Yeah.
And then.
This is where the European
Yeah.
Darts coming in.
That's right. Well, I sort of did my part three quite quickly because I managed to get a job. When I finished my diploma, there was a recession on, so there were jobs were kind of quite hard to get. It was just like the early 90s. And I was fortunate enough to get a job with the tutor. And you know, another stroke of luck, there was this great project, the Seventh Day Adventist Church, which I was made project architect on. And it had all sorts of problems, which is the perfect thing for case study for part two. This is what the RRBA wants, you know. So
yeah.
I was really, really fortunate and was able to do that and just kind of like sail through my part three. So that was great. Because I really didn't want to waste any more time. I'd spent a long time being a student. After that, pretty much the recession is still on, and I did have to find something else to do. I ended up in Paris. A friend over there said they were building a lot of stations. I thought, well, this sounds quite interesting. Went over over there, literally drove over, and for an interview, and got the job. And yeah, that's was the start of my.
You make it sound very kind of, just picked up. I mean, did you speak French?
My parents are from St. Lucia. They were part of the Windrush generation. They came over in the 50s. And on St. Lucia, they speak kind of patois, you know, it's a sort of
Creole, is it?
Creole,
yeah.
So I was kind of attuned to it. I didn't sort of speak fluent French. I was kind of just attuned to it. So I was still speaking English for quite a while, but then around about my sort of second or third year in Paris, I started to speak more French. You know, I was speaking more French than English, really. And I think at that point, I realised that I'd made this kind of subtle transition, into French. So yeah, that was, you know, when people start. Yeah,
there's a story I spoke to Anna Lee Ritchie's some time ago, and she, in a similar story, really looking for work, ended up moving to Paris, from Mikhail Ritchie's, and just kind of in a similar way, kind of winged it really with the language. But I'm kind of interested in how working in an office in English with the French, you're not perhaps known for being accommodating with languages.
No,
but you were, managed. Managed to fit in, and
architecture. It's kind of a visual language, so you could communicate just by sketching something. And I was working with a friend who spoke perfect English, and I was able to translate if there was something I didn't understand. And we were working quite closely together. It was, most people I found were quite happy to speak English. Whereas once they knew you were trying to speak French.
Yeah.
They would say, that's good enough, and let's revert to English now, you know.
Yeah.
So I found that happened. But after about two or three years, they started speaking to me in French. So at that point, I knew.
It was a kind of natural evolution.
My French was good enough.
It's tough, isn't it, when you're trying to learn and everyone just immediately starts speaking English to you, but suddenly when you reach that
point, when they actually just automatically start speaking to you in whatever, French.
And then they might ask about your accent afterwards, finally made it. So it's interesting. I mean, I guess France has always been thought of as a little ahead of the UK in terms of high-speed rail and, big public subsidy to a lot of the infrastructure building, and a real respect for engineering, particularly in France, civil engineering and big kind of public infrastructure works. Mm. You came back to the UK then, but working on one of the early kind of big infrastructure projects in the UK on High Speed 1.
Yes.
To just talk us through, I mean, what made you come back from Paris? What was the factor in thinking time for?
Well, I was sent back by the French.
Right.
they said, oh, we need someone, because as you know, High Speed 1 was a consortium of, I think it was Arup, Sistra. Mm-hmm. Sistra were the French sort of quota, Bechtel were the others, and Halcro as they were then. They were part of this, I think it's called Rail Link Engineering, part of London Continental Railways, which was a consortium that we put together to build HS1. And I was put on St Pancras Station. So I was part of the team working with Alistair Landley, who was, he was ex kind of British Rail, Nick Darmstrom and Alistair Landley, and had been working with Arup. So he was the principal kind of architect on St Pancras. So I was part of his team. And it was a pretty kind of cosmopolitan lot, you know, because I had some French colleagues come over with me, but I was kind of the lead SNCF. SISTRA, or effectively SISTRA, are the international arm of SNCF. So they, you know, they are still sort of SNCF.
Right.
Important to realise that when I went to France, this sort of station design office had kind of just been set up, really, by someone called Jean-Marie Dutilleul.
This is AREP.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. And they would They were working on some big TGV stations, and so there was already a lot of, you know, expertise,
knowledge
there. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, they sort of sent me back to the UK as a British architect. I thought, oh, that's great.
You speak English. You can
exactly. You know, you're putting and it all, you know, it went swimmingly, and I was getting it was great times there because I was being paid fantastically. I had a, you know, I was getting my salary in France, and I was getting an allowance to live in London, and it was absolutely great, you know. And the project was out of this world. So yeah, I had a lot of fun there. I was there for about 2 and a bit years, and then I think the breaks went on. We were dealing with the sort of consents, so we were doing a lot of the strategic conceptual stuff initially. So the big street, St Pancras, that was the big strategic move at that point. And we did a lot of work for getting the planning consents for the scheme. But then at the end of, I think, 98 or going to 99, the brakes put on because of funding issues, and I think the government had to restructure everything. At that point, I had the opportunity, well, I had the choice of either going back to France or, you know, staying in the UK. I decided to stay in the UK because I had two kids in school, effectively. I had one, my daughter was born just before I went over to Paris, and I had a son who was born in Paris, and both of them my daughter was at school in London. And I thought, rather than, you know, kind of moving back again, staying in London, so I had to basically say goodbye to the SNCF, which I was very sad to do, because
that's how life gets in the way sometimes.
Life gets in the way. You've got to make those choices.
Tough choices. But a real, I mean, that's the move then, again, huge change, but some really notable projects you worked on then at Marks Barfield. Which I was thinking this, just before about some questions and the idea of quite a change from big kind of infrastructure projects to the London Eye, which I suppose is, you know, in its own way, a transport project, you know, people.
I think it is. I think it's moving people, you know. It's described as a flight, you know, British Airways always sold it as a flight. Okay, you don't actually go anywhere, you go up and then come down again, but it is still, you know, a transport experience.
Well, I think that's all British Airways are able to offer at the moment anyway, aren't they? Even from just flights to nowhere.
Yeah.
Just be interested, because it was a big chunk of your career then at Marks Barfield, 10 years. Just talk us through their sort of approach. It's quite not a huge office, I guess, at the time in 99.
So there were 12 when I joined, actually 12 people in the office.
Okay.
I mean, the way I actually came to work for Marks Barfield was kind of strange as well. I'd gone to the cinema in Clapham one evening, and I was thinking about what am I going to do next. So I was having to make this decision about, you know, whether I go back to Paris or stay in the UK. And I was walking, it was a lovely, I remember it being a lovely warm afternoon. I was walking down the road, and Mark Sparfield's office is quite close to the Clapham Picture House. It's on the corner. And so I was wandering past, and the door was open, and I looked up these stairs, and there was this sort of image of a, you know, the sort of sketch of the London Eye. I thought, this is interesting. So I actually just wandered in. I walked up the stairs and to reception. I said, well, what's, you know, what are you? And they said, oh, we're an architect's office. And I can't remember who it was. One of the guys on the desk said, oh, are you interested? Why are you sending your CV? And so that's what I did. Sent in my CV. I was invited for an interview. And,
wow.
And got in with the team. It was absolutely, you know,
One of those things.
Yeah. I wasn't kind of, I didn't think, oh, I want to join Mark Sparfield. It just so happened I was walking past the office.
It's a kind of fate, really, yeah, bringing you past an open door.
I think little fates were. Yeah. And I had a thoroughly fantastic 10 years. By far, I think Mark Sparfield, the best practice I've ever worked for.
Yeah. Talk us through, I'm kind of interested in the work there. I mean, I guess people talk about this entrepreneurial style of architecture, and Mark Sparfield have often sort of been associated with that kind of making your own projects, and another connection back to Brighton, the
I-360. I have a funny story about that, but anyway,
I want to hear that. Yeah, we'll come on to that. But just talk us through the sort of approach, because there, as a practice, you know, people, I guess, when they hear an architecture practice are behind the, rather than a product design firm, behind the London Eye and I-360. Just talk us through that architectural approach to design.
Yeah. David Marks was always proud of the fact that the practice was difficult to categorise, because he never liked doing the same project twice. Both he and Julian never liked doing. And I think they were quite proud of that. They saw themselves as being kind of entrepreneurial, a bit community focused, innovative in a way. I think they were actually innovative, but not in the way which, you know, you come up with something groundbreaking all the time. It's just we were thinking of different ways of doing things. That's all, you know, sort of slightly better ways of doing things. So every project was different. But the other thing I liked was it was a very, the ratio of male to female was very even. You know, it was never sort of gender dominated by one gender or another, which I find really kind of refreshing. And to this day, you know, I've never seen that level of kind of, you know,
even, perfect balance.
Yeah, that balance. So that was really enjoyable.
And do you know, I mean, just to pick up on that, do you know how they achieved that? Do you know what they did to, was it...
I don't know whether there's some sort of unconscious,
all conscious decision.
It's not, I mean, I rose to director level, so I was, you know, but that was never a policy, you know.
No.
It wasn't told to me, you know, we have to get X number of, you know, guys and X girls.
So there was just an acceptance.
It was just an acceptance, and it felt, it just, you know, the atmosphere in the studio was very good. It was very calm because of that, I thought. You know. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was excellent. The other thing I think to say about the practice is that they were very kind of structure orientated. So David and Julia were very influenced by, you know, people like Paxton, you know, Brunel, Buckminster Fuller, Decimus Burson, you know, so you see that a lot in their work. Very interested in the structure of things, and they had a very good relationship with Jane Wernick, who was a personal friend, Bennett Arab, and Jane was very much key, I think, to getting the London Eye to work. So I mean, there was a great sort of family atmosphere about that practice, which is why I stayed there for so long. Actually, it was really.
And what's what sort of size was the practice when you left then? Did it stay at that kind of...
Yeah, it was about... It always stayed just around 30. It never went really above 30. Okay. Which was slightly disappointing to me, because for transport, you do need to have a kind of...
A certain scale.
Yeah. And I think it kind of affected us when it came to working for Crosswell, because transport was still my sector, and I was kind of, you know, pushing that. I was brought on board to kind of develop that as a sector. And we did quite well, I think, initially. We got involved in the sort of early scheme designs, reference designs for Crossrail. And we got the TfL framework, and we're doing stuff for TfL.
But limited on some of the bigger stuff by size.
When it came to, you know, the latter stages, you know, the sort of detailed design, where you get involved with the contractors, they were looking for bigger architectural practices. You know, the sort of Grimshaws and the Wilkinson Ayres and the Hawkins Browns. So that's, you know, and I think size played a great deal. But, you know, David and Julia weren't really interested in a big practice. I think they really wanted to stay
that tight, knit, yeah, exactly, kind of size.
And we had opportunity to change offices and didn't do it. But, you know, that's I think the variation of stuff we did was great. I mean, you know, we did everything from stations, bridges, mosques, galleries, treetop walkways, river piers, sky tower housing, you know, tiny boutique cafes, IT parks out in the desert, you know, observation wheels, I-360. Yeah. And the story about I-360 was, in my first year at Brighton, one of the projects we were given, we had a choice. One was some park outside of Brighton, and the other one was the Palace Pier. I chose the Palace Pier, and I put on the end of the Palace Pier, I put a vertical pier. It didn't quite look like the I-360. It was kind of like a helter-skelter thing, right now, but it was an observation pier. So, you know, to go back, and I was involved on the I-360, although it didn't come from that. Didn't come from that college project. It was just a crazy coincidence that years later I'd be involved in Brighton again on a peer project.
I think doing a peer project at the end of the pier would have challenged the engineers even further, I think, than doing it on dry land, maybe. Yeah. But so we probably are just sort of slightly conscious of time. We probably haven't quite got time to run through, you know, see some work at Grimshaw and Scott Brownrigg, but maybe just coming then on to two and a bit years ago, you joining Network Rail, and I guess via, as you say, a bit of time at Grimshaw and some other transport work. But interesting to think then about this revival in appreciation for design at Network Rail and that. You talked about Anthony Dewar's head of
buildings and architecture.
And he's a civil engineer. I think by training. We've obviously, you know, people will have seen some of the work we've done on kind of some of the smaller design projects and things, the benches that have been installed and some of the other kind of competitions coming up. Just talk us through maybe that kind of approach to design then and how that's changing. And I guess, say, we talked earlier about some of the stations, St Pancras, and big changes at Waterloo, the Grimshaw Eurostar terminal, and people are seeing stations as being revived, but the design and actually the architecture, there's a lot of unseen buildings at Network Rail, and how does design come in there? How's that affected?
Anthony is one of those structural engineers who think that, you know, there is a synergy between architecture and structural engineering, and I kind of believe that as well. I saw that when I was working at AREP, because a lot of the guys at Arup were actually both structural engineers and architects. They train at this sort of school where effectively you are both an engineer and an architect. I think that's probably what happened in the old days as well, actually. People like Brunel, you know, they were both. And so we both kind of get the importance of the value of design. In actual fact, we're trying to write something with the Design Council at the moment which talks about the value of design, because we kind of have to demonstrate that, I think, to the rest of the business, because people, there's always the question of why should we do this? You know? And it's, yeah, people accept it when it's in invisible and it's in the big stations. But then when it comes to the sort of small depots and the little sort of buildings that, you know, are on, you know, bits of land somewhere where they think no one is looking, you know, they don't.
Design doesn't matter there. It doesn't matter. Because you can't see it.
But that's not thinking long term, you know, because you will get, you know, a new housing, you know, sort of development, which will spring up and suddenly you've got this eyesore. And so, you know, you have to think about resilience and long term. And Anthony and I are, we make no apologies about it. We are geeks to a certain extent, you know. we love all of the, you know, the railway paraphernalia and the stuff that was done in the 1960s. You know,
and an appreciation for the history of the design. Yeah,
absolutely,
really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, I think, you know, when BR was rebranded in the mid 60s, you know, it really had quite a profound effect, you know, on people's appreciation and their sort of impression of the British Rail, of British Railways. Before then, you know, it was seen as a bit old-fashioned, you know, a bit fuddy-duddy, you know, well, you know, wedded to steam and, you know, nice and lovely. But, you know, come on, we've got airplanes flying around now and streamlined cars, and BR should be a little bit more kind of, you know, progressive. and we feel every now and then, you know, the railways need a bit of a, you know, a kick.
A push, a bit of a kick.
And so we're trying to do that. We are big fans of rebranding if it's necessary. It may seem like an odd time to do it now in the middle of a pandemic, but we started this before the pandemic, so it's kind of a something, you know, that has been, we've been working on for a while. It's been really helped by, you know, the fact that we've got support from
up high.
But I do feel there's a little bit of a wind of change coming here, you know, and maybe COVID has kind of accelerated that a little bit, you know, in terms of what are our station buildings doing? Are they, can they change their purpose in the future, so they become more like kind of communal points of reference or kind of communal hubs, if you like. Can they serve a purpose for a population which is going to want to travel less, but you still want to kind of meet people?
I was going to say, I mean, do you think there's almost a sort of problem when everything is running right at capacity, the idea of trying to make any change when, you know, as people see, even the slightest kind of intervention in a station which is running at, you know, 100% capacity causes all sorts of issues. But suddenly, maybe as capacity is reduced, there's suddenly an opportunity to make changes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think we've got to think that maybe things will never, you know, return to that level of kind of, yes, the sort of rush hour crush, you know, that people are not going to sort of be willing to, you know, accept that anymore. So what's the alternative? I'm sure people don't want to be cooped up in their homes forevermore. They still want to go out. You know, people still need to go out and meet and travel. You know, and exchange things and commerce. You know, that's part of our, you know, social well-being. You need to do that. So it's just about creating places where people can do that. And they could be safe and not have to travel vast distances. So one of the things we're really interested in is this whole idea of micro-mobility and getting from your local station easily, and how these free Wi-Fi, just making stations places where people can go and spend time. And we've always had this problem with what do we, you know, smaller stations, what do we do with them? The TOCs don't really want to look after them.
These are the train operating companies.
They don't really want to look after them. Communities do, you know. Yeah. Increasingly, we've got community rail groups are interested in taking over some of these old buildings. So there is a model. There's possibly a kind of operator model that we're very interested in. We want to help, kind of, you know, in terms of what, you know, how these places are designed, so that they're not just kind of, you know, pretty sort of cruddy looking kind of places. Yeah. You know, with they actually have a sort of a nice, we, you know, can kind of contribute design ideas and that sort of thing. Because we are effectively the landlord to a lot of these places.
Yeah.
The TOCs are just, they are tenants. They might not be there, you know, long term. We'll have to see what the Williams Review.
What the government, decide. But that's, again, a kind of an interesting, almost coming full circle, really, is the role of an architect now looking at coming into planning, really, in the kind of future.
Yeah.
You know, how do stations exist in the, you know, how do they become mixed-use developments, and how do people... and that's starting, is it? Is that the kind of
certainly something,
change?
Yeah,
I think with
certainly something we're looking at. The station competition that we had recently, which we launched, now we've got the entries back and we've shortlisted some entries. That's going to lead on to, we hope, an actual station or prototype station being built at one of the sites. We're choosing the site at the moment. That's the hope. So we can set some standards. We did the same thing, sort of trial run with footbridges, and we got a winner out of that. And that's going to be something we're actually going to build, and hopefully become a kind of standard. Well, we're actually developing a catalogue of bridges, so. Because we know one size doesn't fit all, but we want bridges of better quality than we've had, you know, in the past. We're still having, you know, battles with projects about whether they should or shouldn't, you know, put roofs on footbridges. I think, well, in this day and age, you should put a roof. You know, you shouldn't expect people to sort of have to run across a bridge when it's pouring with rain.
Get soaking wet.
And you know, you wouldn't believe the sort of battles we're going through just to do that. So, yeah, we're trying to sort of improve the whole built infrastructure, I think.
Yeah. So it's all, I mean, it's, you know, I guess people, yeah, there's a lot of conversations going on at the moment about COVID and people adapting that, you know, some huge challenges, I guess, for the railways, but also, you know, some quite interesting opportunities there. And given the work that was begun before COVID, probably in fairly good step in terms of that use of design as a way of coping.
Yeah, I think there are some, you know, I think the winds of change are there. I one of my big tasks at the moment is producing a set of design guidelines. There are about 30 of these documents and they cover all sorts of things from things quite strategic, like, you know, obviously station design as a broad manual. And then think we're talking about things like materials and finishes and components, wayfinding, you know, and also looking at, you know, things like maintenance delivery units and depots, you know. And this is quite a comprehensive set of guidelines, which I don't think we've really ever had as an organisation. And these kind of percolated down from the design principles that we developed. I think they're really mainly because of those. The design principles set a vision for what you want. Moreover, it tells the suppliers and the other people, the sponsors who work with you, what you expect.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, then you end up with what you end up with. and so I was very, that's one of the things that I've learned, you know, during my career. And I'm just grateful for an opportunity to sort of apply what I've learned to that work better. And I've got, you know, working with Anthony, I've got that opportunity because I think we both, you know, sort of on the way the same, on the same wavelength.
Just helpful. Yeah. I guess then, I say we're really tight for time. Just to finish off, really, I'm really into this sort of idea. Really, I mean, you talked about High Speed 1 and, you know, this kind of connection with Europe and the kind of first introduction really of proper high-speed rail into the UK and this kind of connection with Europe. I'm really interested, yeah, we are as a podcast, yeah, as a festival, interested in the cities that we live in as much as the,
yeah,
the kind of, just interested in what you miss from Paris really, and what, when you were living in Paris, what you missed from London, you know, the two very different cities.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, architecturally as much as societally and everything else, what did you miss about London in Paris, and what do you miss about Paris in London? Or as London, I hear a number of people talking about how London's changed, know, become more European. I mean, it's, you know, Brexit aside, but yeah, become more European.
Yeah,
have we learned from the Europeans?
I think there's some things we do better than Europe and other things we don't. In France, what I was really struck by was the speed at which things got done. Like, stations went up really quickly. You know, whereas here, they, you know, it takes a long time. It takes a decade, you know, for something like London Bridge, you know, just to be changed, because there's so many stakeholders. In France, things seem to happen really quickly. I was amazed, actually, as something went from a drawing board to kind of being up on site. And the other thing I noticed was really the cost of building seemed to be lower, up to about, you know, half, you know, definitely right. 2/3, but up to half. And the other good thing was I was being paid more in France when I went over there. I don't know, I think architects seem to have a slightly higher profile than, or at least
in
they're
society,
slightly, yeah,
absolutely,
they're slightly kind of revered a little bit more. So I was on when I went over there, and bearing in mind I'd only just qualified really. I was on, you know, what I would have thought a well-established architect would be on in the UK.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Sort of doctors, you know, doctors and lawyers maybe are what I talked about here, but in France. In France, certainly engineers and architects
are well paid, I think, and particularly as I was working for the public sector, effectively, and the SNCF, I was quite surprised.
That's certainly something we can learn in the UK, bigger respect for the profession.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, in fact, you know, I'm just hoping we don't become extinct, actually, as architects. Yeah. So many things happening at the moment. Yeah. Premiums for insurance and everything. I found that the reasons buildings were cheaper in Paris is that they're kind of quite bold in shape, and that, you know, and we were given free rein basically to come up with all these great station design office to come up with all these great shapes, but the specifications weren't really great. So I've been back to Paris recently, you can see where, you know, the quality of the of the materials and the detail isn't quite as good as it is over here.
So there is a flip side.
There is absolutely a flip side. Yeah, there's absolutely a flip side. So, you know, the architects over there don't have a say when it comes to specifying the final product.
Okay.
Whereas over in the UK, and I have noticed this actually, architects do tend to have more of a handle on specification, even when it goes to the contractor. The buildings turned out to be cheaper. Also, they don't really have project managers over in France. They have kind of, I think, something called a maître d'œuvre, which is sort of a master of works. And it's not the same thing as a project manager. I think things can get kind of a little bit bogged down with project management. The contractor has much more of a sort of hand. You cut out almost like that middleman of project management. So those are the main things. I loved life in France, Paris. It was almost like living in a kind of Jacques Tati film, you know, a film, basically. Everything was, it was 100 miles an hour, really.
I lived in Brussels for 6 years, and that was, and she lived in France for a couple of years. I think it's really valuable to have seen, as you're talking about some of those differences, things, you know, that if you think about how bad things might be in your own kind of country, you can see what's better, you can see what's worse. It's just a perspective, really, and a different perspective.
It is a different perspective
that brings. And
that's
well, I hope young people are still going to be able to, live and work abroad. Yeah,
for me, that's the great, the great shame of Brexit, and that's why I was thinking I had this opportunity, and literally I was able to jump in my car, travel over to France and get a job the next week. Yeah. It was really that simple, and I hope people. Us people will be able to still do that. It'll be a little bit harder, but it really expanded my mind as an architect.
Fantastic. That's a really nice run through, from English and European literature back to English and European.
And I think I've kind of come full circle as well in terms of working for the public sector, which I feel. It's funny how that's kind of worked out. But...
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Frank Anatole. You can find out more about Frank and his work at architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, why not leave us a review or a rating with your podcast provider? As this really helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.